simple-minded. She'd never have stood for an hour outside the Dickens Museum like that if she hadn't just been coming down with it. Annie's cell phone rang just as the poppadoms were being served. She didn't recognize the number, which was why she took the call. Hello? The voice was deeper than she had imagined, but weaker too. Tremulous, almost.
Is this Annie?
Yes.
Hello, this is Tucker Crow.
Hello. The first word she had ever said to him, and it came encrusted with ice.
I hope you have a good excuse. Moderately good. Mildly good. I had a mild heart attack pretty much as soon as I got off the plane. I wish I could tell you that it was more serious than that, but there we are. It was enough.
Oh my God, are you okay?
I'm not so bad. Most of the damage seems to be psychic. Apparently I'm not going to live forever as I previously thought.
What can I do?
I'd welcome a visit from somebody outside my own family.
Done. And what can I bring you? Do you need anything?
I could probably use some books, something English and foggy, but not as foggy as Barnaby Rudge.
Annie laughed a little more than Tucker would have understood, got the name of the hospital, ended the call, and blushed. She was always blushing these days. Perhaps she was literally getting younger, shooting all the way backward to prepubescence, and the whole terrible business could start all over again.
And was that one of your stories? Linda asked her. It looks like it from the colour you've turned.
Well, yes, I suppose he is. He was a story, at least, even if he never became anything else. Nobody, she discovered the next morning, ever waited impatiently outside a bookstore for it to open. She was on her own in the cold. She'd got to Charing Cross Road at 8:50, only to discover that none of them opened their doors before 9:30. She went for a coffee, came back, and at 9:31 she was watching through the plate glass door as the staff fiddled around with the displays in the front of the store. What were they doing? Surely they must have worked out that she wasn't hopping up and down because she needed a celebrity cookbook. It was just as well that nobody could die of a thirst for literature. These people would just leave you gasping on the sidewalk. Finally, finally, a young man with stubble and long greasy hair unlocked the door and slid it back, and Annie wriggled through the gap. She'd had a few ideas overnight. Tucker would never find out, but the truth was that she'd been unable to sleep because she'd been constructing a reading list in her head. At 2 in the morning, she'd decided that 10 books would be enough to cover his wants and her enthusiasms. But when she woke up, she could see that turning up with a teetering tower of paperbacks would provide Tucker with all the evidence he needed to prove that she was unbalanced and obsessed. 2 would be plenty. 3, if she really couldn't decide. She ended up buying 4, with the intention of ruling out 2 of them on the way to the hospital. She had no idea whether he'd like them, mainly because she knew nothing about him other than that he liked Dickens. The hospital was somewhere near Marble Arch, so she walked up to Oxford Street and got a bus in what she hoped was a westerly direction. Except, surely everyone who liked 19th-century fiction had read Vanity Fair. And was a book titled Hangover Square an appropriate gift for a recovering alcoholic? And then there was the sex in Fingersmith's. Would he think that was some kind of come-on? And wasn't the sex mostly of the lesbian variety? Would he think she was trying to warn him that she wasn't interested in him in that way, when in fact the whole idea was that she was trying to indicate the opposite? Plus, he'd had a heart attack, so maybe no book containing sex of any variety was tactful. Oh, shit. She looked out the window of the bus, saw a chain bookstore, and got off at the next stop. At the entrance to the hospital, Annie found herself stuffing 4 brand new paperbacks that she couldn't afford into a trash can and feeling sick with guilt. She was throwing the books away because she'd bought too many and didn't know where to hide the ones she didn't need. Also because he might decide that some of her choices were over-obvious and patronizing. Also because she hadn't read 1 or 2 of them, and she should have, and if he asked her what they were about, she would stutter and blush.
She was in a panic, of course. She could see that.
She was nervous, and when she was nervous, she overthought everything.
She caught sight of herself in the mirrored door of the elevator on the way up to his room, and she looked awful, tired and old. Maybe instead of worrying about Victorian novels, she should have worried more about her makeup. And she wished she'd slept better. She never looked good when she'd had less than 7 hours' sleep. He probably wasn't looking so great, though, which was some consolation. Maybe that was the Annie paradox, that she could only appeal to men too sick to do much about anything. She flicked uselessly at her hair and walked out of the elevator and down the hall. On the way to Tucker's room, she saw Jackson walking toward her, hand in hand with an impossibly glamorous but intimidatingly sulky woman in her late 40s. Annie tried to smile at her, but she could feel the smile bounce off the woman's face. Natalie, if that's who the woman was, clearly didn't dish out smiles for no reason, thus devaluing their currency. Annie was glad she had resisted the temptation to introduce herself. She'd have been like one of those crazy women who shout at soap opera stars on the street because they think they know them. Just because Jackson spent his life stuck to her fridge didn't mean that she could run up to him and frighten him half to death. As they walked past, she could see that he looked frightened enough as it was, and Annie hoped that didn't mean she was walking into a room containing a very sick man. Supposing Tucker died when she was in there? And his last words were, "Oh, I've read all those." She'd have to make something up. And she'd never had to deal with a dying person. And it would be grotesquely inappropriate, hers being the last face he saw. Perhaps she should just go home. Or wait until she was sure there was somebody else in there, somebody he actually knew. But then she was knocking on the door and he was saying, "Come in." And before she knew it, she was sitting on his bed and they were beaming at each other.
"I bought you some books," she said, much too soon. The books should have been an afterthought, not an introduction.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I meant to say I'd pay you back. I don't know you well enough to ask you to spend money on me."
She'd asked for that by coming in and yelling about her kindness, idiot.
"Good grief, I don't need paying back. I just didn't want you to think I'd forgotten."
Terrible being in hospital with nothing to read. He nodded at his bedside table.
"I still have old Barnaby, but he's not as much fun as I'd hoped. You read that one?"
Oh, come on, woman, she told herself. "You know the answer to the question. You've read about 4 Dickens novels, and that's not one of them."
Barnaby Rudge isn't going to be a deal-breaker. On the other hand, why take the risk?
"I'm like you," she said brightly. "I got about a third of the way through it and put it down. Anyway, you've had a heart attack and we're talking about me not finishing a book. How are you?"
"Not so bad."
"Really?"
"Yeah." "Tired. A little anxious about Jackson."
"I think I saw him walking down the corridor."
"Yeah. Natalie's taken him to a toy store. It's all too weird."
"They'd never met before this trip?"
"Shit, no."
She laughed at his eyes widening in alarm.
"Why would I do that to him? And I want him to look up to me. I don't want him judging me on the basis of my past mistakes."
"But she's being nice to him."
"Yeah, I guess. And me. Her old man paid for us to fly over here. And then I keel over in the reception of the fanciest hospital in London, so he gets to pay for that, too."
He laughed wheezily. "So she's not all that bad."
"Apparently not. Now I find out."
"How did you end up married to an Englishwoman?"
"Oh."
And he waved a hand as if a wife from another continent were inevitable at some stage in the career of a serial husband, and the details were therefore wearingly inconsequential. She told herself not to ask too many questions, even though there was so much she wanted to know about him. She liked to think she was curious about people, but her hunger for information went beyond curiosity. She wanted to piece the entirety of his adult life together, and she seemed to be lacking even the straight edges that would get her started. Why did she care so much? Part of it was because of Duncan, of course.
She was thinking with his fan's head, and she felt obliged to collect as much information as she could, because nobody else was in a position to do so. But it wasn't just that. She'd never been given the opportunity to meet someone this exotic, and she feared she'd never be given it again unless some other vanished bohemian contacted her out of the blue. "Ah," she said, "one of those."
"Did that seem as if I'm being mysterious?" he said.
"It seemed as though you weren't feeling up to talking about the marriage before last as someone you've only just met."
"Perfect. Amazing what you can do with the limp flap of a wrist."
"How's your daughter doing?"
"Not so great. Okay physically, but angry. Angry with me, too."
"With you?"
"I've gone and fucked it all up for her again. For once, she was supposed to be the center of attention."
"I'm sure that's not what she means." In the first 5 minutes, she had defended both Lizzie and Natalie, and she vowed not to say anything nice about anybody related to Tucker for the remainder of the visit. It made her sound bland and boring and good, and exactly the sort of person that a reclusive cult musician in recovery wouldn't like.
If she knew anything about reclusive cult musicians in recovery, which she didn't.
And in any case, there was every chance that these people were horrible. She'd only seen Natalie for 2 seconds in the hallway, but those 2 seconds had been salutary. They suggested to her that the rich and beautiful really were different. "I'm sure that's not what she means. How would she know what the daughter of a model meant?" "Do you know many people in London?"
"Nope. Lizzie and Nat. And you, now that you're in London."
"So you haven't been bombarded with visitors?"
"Not yet. But I understand there are a fair few on their way."
"Really?"
"Really. Nat and Lizzie decided in their wisdom that my children should all come here to see me before I croak. So I've got 3 more kids and another ex-wife on the way."
"Oh. And how do you feel?"
"I don't care for the idea much."
"No. Well, I can see that."
"The truth is, Annie, I'm not going to be able to go through with it. I'm going to need you to get me out of here. If you live in a small seaside town a ways away from this hospital, then that sounds like exactly the sort of place I need to rest up in. Might be fun for Jackson, too."
For a moment, Annie forgot to breathe. She had written that last sentence for him several times since he'd called to tell her what had happened, although it sounded better in his voice, of course. And there were some linguistic details that she'd never have come up with. A ways away. Rest up. And then, after she had started inhaling and exhaling again, with a little more noise than she might have wished, she started thinking about train times. She'd been intending to get the 2:12, unless she'd been given a compelling or even mildly plausible reason to stay in London. If Jackson came back from the toy store in time, they could jump in a cab to King's Cross and be back in Goulinus by 4:30.
"What do you think?"
She'd not only forgotten to breathe, she'd forgotten that she was supposed to be taking part in a conversation with a real person. "I don't think Jackson would have much fun. It's not such a fun place, especially this time of year."
"You still got that shark's eye?"
"I have loads of pieces of shark."
"Well, that's a happy afternoon right there."
The trouble was, she couldn't help but be boring and bland and sensible and good. There was nothing she wanted more than to nurse Tucker back to health and goulinus. Yet the desire was untrustworthy and dangerously, self-indulgently whimsical. It was the crush talking. For a start, he'd had a heart attack, not a bout of flu. He probably didn't need blankets and hot water bottles and homemade soup. For all she knew, any of those things might kill him. And stealing him away from his family, it seemed to her, would be wrong and bad, and none of her business. She tried not to think conventionally, but she probably did believe that families were important, that fathers had a duty to their children, that Tucker couldn't just run away from them out of fear or embarrassment or both. All of these doubts, when she examined them, started to lead to the unwelcome conclusion that Tucker was a real person, with actual problems, and neither he nor the problems could comfortably be accommodated in her life, or in her house, or in goulinus. If that was where doubts led, then she didn't especially want to follow them. I don't know if I'm capable of looking after you. I mean, what have they done to you, and what still needs doing?
They gave me an angioplasty.
Ah, well, I don't even know what that is. I couldn't give you another one.
Jesus, I wouldn't ask you to.
Was it all in her imagination, or was this part of the conversation vaguely smutty?
Smutty and prudish all at the same time, seeing as she was refusing to do things, and he was saying he wouldn't ask for them in the first place.
Almost certainly it was her imagination.
Maybe if she'd taken Barnsley up on his offer the other night, she'd be less preoccupied now.
What is it?
Basically, they put little balloons into you and blow them up to clear your arteries.
So you've had an operation? In the last 36 hours?
It wasn't such a big deal. They stick the balloons in with the catheter.
And do you really want to run away from your kids when they're flying halfway across the world to see you?
Yes.
She laughed. It was the kind of yes that knew its own mind.
Your boys? They fly across the Atlantic aged, what?
12, give or take.
And their dad has checked out of the hospital and can't be found?
Precisely. It's not any one child I don't want to see. It's all of them. Because you know what? I've never seen them all in the same room together. Never have. Never wanted to. So I need to get out while the going's good.
Seriously? You've never been with all your children at the same time?
God, no. The mechanics of that.
He shuddered theatrically.
How long have you got before they all get here?
The boys arrive this afternoon. Lizzie's downstairs. Jackson, you know about. So that just leaves Grace. Nobody seems to know where she is.
Where does she live?
Ah, he said. Well, now this isn't going to sound good.
You're not sure?
Not sure is a kind way of putting it. It suggests I might be able to offer you some kind of idea.
But someone knows.
Oh, someone always knows. The most recent partner always has a way of getting in touch with the one before, so they just work the chain all the way back.
How come they know how to get in touch?
Because I let the women make the arrangements involving children, I guess. I wasn't very good at it, and the current partner always wanted to show the previous one she was a decent and caring human being, so... I know, it kind of reflects badly on me, doesn't it?
Annie tried to get her face to register the disapproval he seemed to be expecting, and then gave up.
To disapprove would be to diminish him, turn him into the sort of person she already knew. She wanted and needed to hear about his complicated domestic life. And to suggest that she didn't much like it might mean he stopped telling her stories that she would remember forever.
No, she said.
He looked at her.
Really? Why not?
She didn't know why not, really.
Losing touch with daughters through indolence and carelessness was, on the face of it, an unattractive habit.
I think people end up doing things they're good at. If your partners were better at making arrangements, then what's the point of leaving it to you to mess up?
For a moment, she allowed herself to imagine that Duncan had a daughter from a previous relationship, and she was the one who had ended up speaking to the child's mother while he scratched his balls and listened to his Tucker Crowe bootlegs. Is that the view she would have taken in those circumstances?
Almost certainly not.
I don't think you really believe that. Or if you do, you're the first woman I've ever met who does. But I thank you for your tolerance. Anyway, this isn't getting me out of here.
I'll get you out when you've seen them all.
No, see, it'll be too late by then. The whole point of going is so I don't see them.
I know, but I'd feel guilty, and you don't want that.
Listen, will you be able to come again tomorrow, or do you have to go back?
Incredibly, there was more blushing. Would it never stop? Was she going to blush forever at anything anyone said? This time it was more of a flush than a blush. A response to the pleasurable sense of being needed by somebody she found attractive. And it occurred to her that the physiological response might have happened at any time in the last 15 years. It was simply that there'd been no pleasure, of this kind at least, to be taken.
No,
she said. I don't have to go back. I can, you know. And she could. She could take vacation days and get one of the friends to open up the museum. She could stay with Linda. She could do whatever it took.
Great. Hey, here she is.
Tucker was referring to the dramatically pale young woman who was walking slowly toward them in her bathrobe.
Lizzie, meet Annie.
Lizzie evidently didn't want to meet Annie because she ignored her. Annie found herself hoping Tucker would tell her off, but that was unrealistic. These two had to share a hospital. And in any case, Lizzie was scary. Grace was in Paris. She said she'll be here tomorrow.
Did you tell her she doesn't need to come now that we know I'm not on the way out?
No. Of course she needs to come.
Why?
Because this has gone on long enough.
What?
You keeping us apart.
I don't keep you all apart. I just don't get you all together.
Annie stood up. I should, you know...
So you'll be in tomorrow?
Annie looked at Lizzie, who didn't look back. Maybe tomorrow isn't...
It is, really.
Annie took his hand and shook it. She wanted to squeeze it, too, but she didn't.
Hey, thanks for the books, he said. They're perfect.
Goodbye, Lizzie, said Annie provocatively. Okay, so you can call Grace and tell her she's not welcome, said Lizzie. Annie was getting the hang of it now, and she was quite enjoying it. Even the rudeness was exotic and precious and enviable.
Chapter 13. So none of this is really for my benefit, said Tucker. He said it, he thought, mildly. Mild was the word of the week. He was determined to be mild forever. Or at least until he had a serious heart attack, at which point he would become serious. Or frivolous, depending on the directional advice he received from specialists.
I'd sort of hoped it was, said Lizzie. I'd sort of hoped that you might want to see us all together.
There was something weird about Lizzie's voice. It was deeper than it had been a couple minutes earlier before Annie had left. It was as if she were trying out for one of those Shakespeare plays where a young woman disguises herself as a young man. She was speaking more quietly than she usually did, too. And on top of that, her tone was disconcertingly pacific. Tucker didn't like it. It made him feel as though he were much sicker than he'd been told. Why are you talking like that?
Like what?
Like you're about to have a sex change operation.
Fuck off, Tucker!
Well, that's better.
Why should everything be for your benefit anyway? Can you really not imagine a small pocket of human activity that isn't?
I just thought you were all gathering because I was dangerously sick, and now that I'm not, we can forget all about it.
We don't want to forget all about it.
You're speaking for who here? Everyone? The majority? The senior members? 'Cause I don't think Jackson gives too much of a shit one way or the other.
Oh, Jackson. Jackson thinks what you tell him to think.
That often happens with six-year-olds. Maybe the withering contempt is inappropriate.
I'm sure I'm speaking for the majority when I say that I wish we'd all had the protection that Jackson has been offered.
Oh, right, because you've all had such fucking miserable lives, haven't you? If this conversation were a prophet, it would be one of those scary Old Testament guys rather than gentle Jesus, meek and mild.
Mildness was clearly an elusive quality. You couldn't just turn it on and off when you felt like it. But then, that was the trouble with relationships generally. They had their own temperature and there was no thermostat. And that gets you off the hook.
I'd say that on the whole it does, yes. If I'd left you all in the shit, then I'd feel worse than I do.
It was nothing to do with you, us surviving.
Not strictly true.
Oh, is that right?
He knew it was, but he didn't know how to explain it without causing more trouble. His paternal talent, before Jackson anyway, came down to this. He only impregnated charismatic and beautiful women, and after he had made a mess of them, they were pursued by successful men. They were pursued by unsuccessful men too, of course, but by then they were all done with fuck-ups of any kind, so they sought out decent, solvent partners who could offer stability and material comfort. It was all pretty basic Darwin, really, although he wondered what Darwin would have to say about the coupling with Tucker that resulted in the women becoming mothers in the first place. There wasn't much evidence of an instinct for survival there. So that was it. His aftercare service. It was better than a trust fund, if you thought about it. Trust funds ruined kids. Fond, well-heeled, but clear-eyed stepfathers didn't. It wouldn't work for everyone, you could see that, but it had worked for him. There was even a little blowback, too, seeing as how Lizzie's stepfather was footing his hospital bill. He wouldn't go so far as to say the guy, and he'd forgotten his name again, owed him. But it was quite the charming family he'd inherited so long as he was prepared to overlook the charmlessness. Probably not. It was too sophisticated an idea to explain from a prone position. Lizzie took a deep breath. "I was thinking," she said. "This was the only way it was ever going to happen, wasn't it?" She was trying to sound like a boy again. He wished she'd just choose a voice and stick to it. "What?" "Your life gathering around you. You've always been so good at hiding from it and running from it, and now you're stuck in bed, and it's heading toward you."
"And you think that's what a sick man needs?"
He could try, couldn't he? It wasn't as if a heart attack were a pretend illness. Even a mild coronary was serious, relatively speaking. He was entitled to a little R&R.
"It's what a grieving woman needs. I've lost a child, Tucker."
Her voice had changed key for the third or fourth time. He was glad he didn't have to provide guitar accompaniment. He'd be retuning every couple of minutes. "So, like I said, it's not really for my benefit."
"Exactly. It's for ours. But who knows, it might do you some good."
Maybe she was right. Kill or cure. If Tucker had any money, he knew which of those outcomes he would bet on. When Lizzie had gone, he picked up the books Annie had left him and read the blurbs on the covers. They looked pretty good. She was the only person he knew in this whole country, maybe in any country, who could have done that for him, and he suddenly felt the lack, both of her and of the sorts of friends who might have provided the service. Annie was much prettier than he'd imagined her to be. Although she was the sort of woman who'd be amazed to hear that she could hold her own against somebody like Natalie, who knew, still, the effect she had on men. And, of course, because she didn't know she was pretty, she worked hard to be attractive in other ways. As far as Tucker was concerned, it was work that paid off. He really could imagine resting up in some bleak but beautiful seaside town, taking walks along the cliffs with Jackson and a dog they'd maybe have to rent for the occasion. What was that English period movie where Meryl Streep stared out to sea a lot? Maybe Gulenus would be like that. Jackson came back from a visit to the toy store with Natalie holding an oversized plastic bag. "You look like you did well," said Tucker.
"Yeah."
"What did you choose?"
"A kite and a soccer ball."
"Oh. Okay, I thought you were going to buy something that made it less boring for you in here."
"Natalie said she'd take me outside to play with them, maybe before we go to the zoo this afternoon."
"Natalie's taking you to the zoo?"
"Well, who else is there to go with?"
"Are you angry with me, Jack?"
"No."
They hadn't really had any kind of conversation since the unfortunate medical event. Tucker hadn't known what to say or how to say it, or even whether it was worth saying. "So why don't you want to talk to me?"
"I don't know."
"I'm sorry about what happened," said Tucker.
"This soccer ball is what the pros use in England and other countries."
"Cool, you can teach me some tricks when we're out of here."
"Will you be able to play soccer?"
"Even better than I could before." Jackson bounced the ball on the floor. "Maybe not in here, Jack. Somebody somewhere will be trying to get some rest." "Bounce. Oh, you are mad at me. I'm just bouncing a ball." "I understand. I promised you I wouldn't get sick."
"You promised me you couldn't die if you were well the day before."
"Do I look dead to you?" "Bounce. Because I'm not. And the truth is, I didn't feel well the day before." "Bounce. Okay, Jack, give me the ball."
"No."
"Bounce, bounce, bounce. Okay, I'm coming to get it." Tucker made a show of pulling the sheets back from the bed. Jackson let out a wail, threw the ball over to his father, and collapsed onto the floor with his hands over his ears. "Come on, Jack,"
said Tucker. It's not such a big deal. I asked you to stop bouncing the ball, and you wouldn't. And now you have. I wasn't going to give you a beating.
I'm not scared of that, said Jackson. Lizzie said that if you strain your heart, you'll die. I don't want you to get out of bed.
Well, thank you, Lizzie. Okay, Tucker said, so don't make me. Whatever works, he thought wearily. But it was going to be hard to pretend from now on that he was just your regular elementary school dad.
Jesse and Cooper turned up later that afternoon looking disheveled and bewildered and resentful. They were both wearing iPods, they were both listening to hip-hop with one ear. The other white buds, the ones they'd removed in the clearly unexpected event that their father might say something they'd want to hear, hung loose by their sides. Hey, boys. Mumbled greetings were formed in his son's throats and emitted with not quite enough force to reach him. They dropped somewhere on the floor at the end of his bed, left for the cleaning staff to sweep up. Where's your mother?
Huh?
Said Jesse.
Yeah, she's okay, said Cooper.
Hey, fellas, you don't want to turn those things off for a little while?
Huh?
Said Jesse.
No thanks,
said Cooper. He said it politely enough, so Tucker understood that he was turning down something else entirely, the offer of a drink, maybe, or an invitation to the ballet. Tucker performed a little mime restating his desire to converse without the hearing impediments. The boys looked at each other, shrugged, and stuffed the iPods into their pockets. They had acceded to his request not because he was their father, but because he was older than them, and possibly because he was in a hospital bed. They'd have done the same thing if he were a paraplegic stranger on a bus. In other words, they were decent enough kids, but they weren't his kids. I was asking where your mother was.
Oh, okay, she's outside in the hall.
Cooper did most of the talking, but always managed to give the impression that he was channeling his twin brother somehow. Maybe it was the way they stood side by side, staring straight ahead, arms dangling from their sockets. She doesn't want to come in?
I guess.
You don't want to get her?
No.
That was my way of saying, would you get her?
Oh, okay.
They both walked to the door, peered right and then left, and beckoned their mother toward them.
He wants you to, though.
And then after a pause long enough to accommodate dissent,
I don't know why. She doesn't really want to come in, said Cooper. But she's coming in, said Jesse.
Okay. She didn't come in.
So where is she?
They had readopted their previous position, standing stiffly side by side, staring straight ahead. Maybe when they turned their iPods off, they'd somehow turned themselves off, too. They were in standby mode.
Maybe the restroom, said Cooper. Yeah, I think so, said Jesse. The restroom, and maybe there was someone in there already?
Oh, said Tucker. Sure. Tucker suddenly became wearied by the pointlessness of the exercise that Lizzie had planned. These kids had flown thousands of miles to stand in a hospital room and stare at a man they no longer knew very well at all. This debate about whether their mother had gone to the bathroom or not was the most animated conversation the three of them had managed so far. Tucker would miss it when it was over, but to extend it any further would probably entail scatological detail that he wouldn't feel comfortable with, although the boys might enjoy it. And then, in a moment, the ambient room temperature would become further chilled by the arrival of an ex-wife. Not one that he was particularly afraid of, nor one that bore him a great deal of ill will, as far as he knew, but not a person he'd had any real desire to see again during the time remaining to him on the planet. And then, sometime in the next hour or two, this ex-wife would bump into another one when Nat came back with Jackson. And these two boys would stare at a half-sister they'd never seen before and mumble at her and, Jesus. There had been a part of him that was half-joking when he'd asked English Annie to get him out of here, but that part was gone now. There was nothing funny about this. The door opened, and Carrie peered in around it cautiously. "This is us," said Tucker cheerily. "Come on in."
Carrie took a few steps into the room, stopped, and stared at him.
Jesus,
she said. Thanks, said Tucker.
Sorry, I just meant...
That's okay, said Tucker. I got a lot older. Plus, the light in here isn't so flattering. Plus, I had a heart attack. I accept all of these things with equanimity.
No, no, said Carrie. I just meant, I guess, Jesus, it's been a while since I saw you.
Okay, said Tucker. Let's leave it at that. Carrie, of course, looked good, healthy, and sleek. She'd put on weight, but she'd been too skinny when he'd left her anyway, due to the misery he'd inflicted on her, so the few extra pounds indicated only psychic health.
How have you been? She said.
Today and yesterday, not so bad. The day before, not great. The last few years, mostly not so bad.
I heard you and Kat split.
Yeah, I managed to mess up another one.
I'm sorry.
I'll bet.
No, really, I don't suppose we have a whole lot in common, but we all worry about you. It's better for us if you're in a relationship.
You're all in some sort of recovery group together?
No, but you're the father of our children. We need you to be okay.
Carrie's choice of words allowed him to imagine that he was some kind of polygamist in an isolated religious community, that Carrie was here as the elected representative of the wives. It was certainly hard to think of himself as a single man. He tried for a moment. Hey, I'm single. I have no ties to anyone. I can do what I want. Nope. Wasn't working for some reason. Maybe when he was off the drip attached to his arm, he'd feel a little more footloose. Thank you. How have you been, anyway?
I'm fabulous, darling. Thank you. Work's good. Jesse and Cooper are good, as you can see.
Tucker felt obliged to look, although there wasn't too much to look at apart from a brief flicker of animation at the sound of their own names.
My marriage is good.
Great.
I have a fantastic social life. Doug's business is solid.
Excellent. He was working on the basis that if he threw enough approving adjectives in her direction, she'd stop, but this policy showed no signs of working.
Last year, I ran a half marathon.
He was reduced to shaking his head in speechless admiration.
My sex life is better than it's ever been.
Finally, the boys came out of standby. Jesse's face creased into a mask of distaste, and Cooper crumpled as if he'd been punched in the stomach.
Gross, he said. Please, Mom, stop.
I'm a healthy woman in her 30s. I'm not going to hide.
Good for you, said Tucker. I'll bet your bowels work better than mine, too.
You'd better believe it, said Carrie.
Tucker was beginning to wonder whether she had actually gone crazy at some point in the last decade. The woman he was talking to bore no resemblance to the one he used to live with. The Carrie he knew was a shy young woman who had wanted to combine her interest in sculpture with her interest in disabled children. She loved Jeff Buckley and R.E.M. and the poetry of Billy Collins. The woman in front of him wouldn't know who Billy Collins was.
There's a lot to be said for being a suburban soccer mom, Carrie said, no matter what people like you think.
Oh, okay, now he got it. They were fighting some kind of culture war. He was the cool rock and roll singer-songwriter who lived in the village somewhere and took drugs, and she was the little woman he'd left behind in Nowhere County. The fact was that they lived remarkably similar lives, except Jackson played Little League, not soccer, and Carrie had almost certainly been to New York City more recently than he had. She probably even smoked a little pot at some time in the last 5 years, too. Maybe everyone was going to come in here swinging their insecurities like baseball bats. That would certainly spice things up a little. They were saved by the return of Jackson, who ran the length of the room in order to punch both Jesse and Cooper in the stomach. They responded with smiles and whoops. Finally, somebody was speaking their language. Natalie's entrance was a little more stately. She waved a greeting to the boys who ignored her and introduced herself to Carrie. Or maybe she was reintroducing herself, Tucker couldn't remember. Who knew who had already met before? They were definitely checking each other out now. He could tell that Natalie had absorbed Carrie completely and then somehow spat her out again, and that Carrie knew she'd been spat out.
Tucker accepted completely that women were the fairer and wiser sex, but they were also irredeemably vicious when the occasion demanded. The boys were still fighting. Tucker noted gloomily that Jackson was responding to the appearance of his half-brothers with enormous relief and enthusiasm. Their chief attraction was that they showed no signs of being about to die, unlike their father. Kids could smell those things. The rats who left sinking ships weren't morally culpable. They were just wired that way. How was the zoo, Jackson?
It was cool. Natalie bought me this.
It was a pen with a monkey's head precariously attached to its cap.
Wow. Did you say thank you?
He was impeccably behaved, said Natalie. A pleasure to be with, and he knows more or less everything there is to know about snakes.
I don't know how long all of them are, said Jackson modestly.
The boys stopped wrestling, and a silence fell on the assembled company.
So here we all are, said Tucker. Now what?
I suppose this is where you read your last will and testament, said Natalie, and we find out which of your kids you love the best.
Jackson looked at her and then at Tucker.
It was Natalie's idea of a joke, son, said Tucker.
Oh, okay. But I suppose you'd tell us you loved us all the same, said Jackson,
and the tone of his voice implied that this state of affairs would be unsatisfactory and possibly mendacious.
He'd be right, too, thought Tucker. How could he love them all the same?
Just seeing Jackson and his ill-concealed bundle of neuroses in the same room as those two solid and, let's face it, dull and kind of dumb boys exposed the lie for what it was. He could see that fatherhood was important when you actually were a father, when you sat with kids in the middle of the night and convinced them that their nightmares were as insubstantial as smoke, when you chose their books and their schools, when you loved them however hard they made it for you to feel anything other than irritation and occasional fury. And he had been around for the twins during the first few years, but ever since he'd left their mother, he'd cared for them less and less. How could it be any other way? He tried to pretend to himself that all five of them were equally important, but these two annoyed and bored him. Lizzie was poisonous, and he didn't really know Gracie at all. Oh, sure, most of this was his fault, and he'd like to think that if he and Carrie had survived, Jesse and Cooper wouldn't be quite so fucking characterless. But the truth was that they were fine. They had a perfectly serviceable dad with his own car rental company, and they were mystified by everybody's insistence that their relationship with a man who lived far away was somehow important to their well-being. Meanwhile, Jackson tweaked some kind of nerve in his dad's gut simply by turning on the TV when he was still half asleep in the morning. You couldn't love people you didn't know unless you were Christ. Tucker knew enough about himself to accept that he wasn't Christ. So, who did he love, apart from Jackson? He ran through a quick mental checklist. No, Jackson was pretty much it nowadays. With five kids and all the women, he never thought for a moment that a shortage of numbers was going to be his particular problem. Weird how things turned out.
I'm pretty tired, he said. How about you all go and visit Lizzie?
Will Lizzie want to be visited by us, though? Carrie asked.
Sure, he said. That's part of the point of all this, that we get to know each other as a family.
And if it all happened in somebody else's hospital room, then so much the better.
They came back a couple of hours later, giggly and apparently melded together into a coherent unit. They had picked up an extra member, too. A young man with a ridiculous bushy beard who was carrying a guitar.
Have you met Zach? Said Natalie. He's your something or other, your common-law son-in-law.
Big fan, said Zach. I mean, really big.
That's nice, said Tucker. Thank you.
Juliet changed my life.
Great, I mean, great if your life needed changing, that is, and maybe it didn't.
It did.
So great, happy to have helped.
Zach wants to play you a couple of his songs, said Natalie. But he was too shy to ask himself.
How bad could death be, really? Tucker wondered.
A quick heart attack and out, and he would have avoided hearing songs by bearded common-law sons-in-law for his entire life.
Be my guest, said Tucker. You've got a captive audience.
Who's yours? Gina asked Duncan. They were listening to Naked again. For a week, they'd been living off bootleg performances of the Juliet songs. Duncan had made 9 different playlists that followed the running order of the album, each taken from different nights of the 86 tour. Gina eventually professed a preference for studio albums, though on the grounds that drunk people didn't shout all the way through her favourite tracks. Who's my what? Your, what does he call her? Princess Impossible. I don't know. Most of the women I've had relationships were pretty reasonable, really. That's not what he's on about, though, is it? Duncan stared at her. Nobody had ever attempted to argue with him about Tucker Crowe's lyrics. Not that Gina was arguing with him, exactly. But she seemed to be on the verge of an interpretation that differed from his own, and it made him feel a little irritable. What's he on about, then, oh great Crowologist? Sorry, I didn't mean to... I'm not setting myself up as an expert. Good, he said, and laughed. It takes a while. I'm sure. But isn't she Princess Impossible because she's out of reach, not because she's an impossible person? Well, he said generously, that's the great thing about great art, isn't it? It can mean all sorts of things, but by all accounts, she was very difficult. In that first song, though, And You Are, yes, that one. There's that line in there. They told me that talking to you would be chewing barbed wire with a mouth ulcer, but you never once hurt me like that. How does that fit in with her being impossible if she never once hurt him like that? She became impossible later, I suppose. I thought it was more, you know, her being out of his reach. Your Royal Highness way up there and me on the floor below. Isn't it that he thinks he's out of her league? Duncan felt himself panicking a little. A lurch in the stomach, the sort of thing you get when you know you've left your keys on the kitchen table just after you've shut the front door. He'd invested quite a lot in Juliet's impossibility. If he hadn't got it right, then who was he? No, he said, but he offered up nothing more. Well, you know more about it than me, as you say. Anyway, if that is what he meant, which he didn't, no... Forgetting about Tucker and Juliet, because I'm interested anyway. Have you had one of those? When you knew you were out of your depth? Oh, well, I expect so. He flicked through the index file of his sexual relationships, much of which consisted of blank cards kept at the back. He looked under I for impossible, and D for depth out of, but there was nothing. He could think of friends who'd had that sort of experience, but the truth was that Duncan had never so much attempted to form an attachment to someone as glamorous as Juliet, or indeed to anyone who could be described as glamorous. He knew his place, and it was 2 floors below, not 1, thus preventing any kind of contact at all. You couldn't even see unattainable women from where he usually stood. If you imagined it all as a department store... He was in the basement with the lamps and the dishes. The Juliets were all in ladies' intimates a couple of escalator rides away. Go on. Oh, you know, the usual thing. How did he meet her? It struck Duncan that, as they were already in the kingdom of the self-deprecating, he had to come up with something, otherwise it was all too grim. Nobody was so big a loser that he didn't even have a story about losing. He tried to conjure up the kind of exoticism Gina would be expecting. He saw dramatic eye makeup, elaborate hairdos, glittery clothes. Do you remember that band, The Human League? Yes, of course! God! Duncan smiled enigmatically. You went out with one of the girls in The Human League? And immediately Duncan lost his nerve. There was probably a website which provided a helpful list of all the names of all the men that the girls in The Human League had dated. She'd be able to check. Oh, no, my ex wasn't actually in the Human League. She was in a sort of second-rate version at college. This was more like it. Same deal, synthesizers and funny haircuts. Anyway, we didn't last very long. She went off with a bass player from some other 80s band. What about yours? Oh, an actor.
He slept with everyone at drama college. I was silly enough to think I was different. He'd negotiated that pretty well, he thought. They were well matched in their failures. He was, however, still feeling uneasy about whether he'd spent 2 decades misreading the tenor of the relationship between Tucker and Juliet. Does it make any difference, do you think, whether Juliet was impossible as in difficult or impossible as in out of reach? Any difference to what? Or who?
I don't know, I'd feel a bit daft if I'd been wrong all this time.
How can you be wrong? You know more about this album than anyone on the planet. Anyway, like you say, there's no such thing as wrong. Had he ever listened to Juliet in the way Gina heard it? He was beginning to wonder. He'd like to think that there wasn't a single allusion he'd missed in the lyrics or in the music. The steal from Curtis Mayfield here, the nod to Baudelaire there. But maybe he'd spent so long underneath the surface of the album that he'd never come up for air, never heard what a casual listener might hear. Maybe he'd spent too long translating something that had been written in English all along.
"Oh, let's change the subject," he said.
"Sorry," said Gina. "It must be awfully annoying me chirruping away without knowing the first thing about anything. I can see how this sort of thing gets addictive, though."
When Annie went to visit Tucker the next morning, he was dressed and ready to go. Jackson was sitting beside him, red-faced and looking swamped in a blue puffy jacket that had clearly not been designed with warm hospitals in mind.
"Okay," said Tucker. "Here she is. Let's go."
The two of them walked past Annie and toward the door. Jackson's showy determination, all jutting jaw and quick, even steps, led Annie to believe that the move had been rehearsed to within an inch of its life. "Where are we going?" said Annie.
"Your place," said Tucker.
He was already halfway down the hall, so she could only catch his words by scurrying after him, and even then she nearly dropped them. "My hotel or Goulinus?"
"Yeah, that one, the seasidey one. Jackson needs some saltwater taffy, don't you, Jackson?"
"Yum."
"Some what? I've never heard of it. You won't be able to find it."
The elevator had arrived, and she squeezed in just as the doors were shutting.
"What do you have that he'd like, then?"
"Probably rock candy, but it's pretty bad for your teeth," said Annie. What, she wondered, was her immediate ambition here? Did she want to become the wanton lover of a rocker or a home care nurse? Because she suspected that the two careers were incompatible.
"Thanks," said Tucker. "I'll watch out for that."
She looked at him to see if there was anything in his expression other than impatience and sarcasm. There wasn't. The elevator pinged and the door opened. Tucker and Jackson strode out onto the street, and immediately they started trying to hail cabs.
"How do you know when they're busy? I can't remember," said Tucker.
"The yellow lights."
"Which yellow lights?"
"You can't see it because they're all busy. Tucker, listen."
"Yellow light, Dad!"
"Cool."
The cab pulled over, and Tucker and Jackson got in.
"Which railway station do we need?"
"King's Cross, but..." Tucker gave the cab driver complicated instructions involving a West London address, which Annie presumed was Lizzie's place, and a long journey back across town to the station. She was pretty sure they'd need to stop at an ATM. He had no money, and he'd be shocked by the fare.
"You coming with us?"
said Tucker, as he tugged on the door handle of the cab. It was, of course, a rhetorical question, and she was tempted to decline the invitation, just to see what he said. She jumped in.
"We have to get our luggage from Lizzie's place first. Do you know the train schedule?"
"We'll miss the next one, but probably we'll only have to wait 30 minutes or so for the one after."
"Time for a comic book, a cup of coffee?"
"I don't know if I've ever been on an English train."
"Tucker!" said Annie.
The word came out shrill and unpleasant, and much louder than she had intended. Jackson looked at her in alarm. If she were him, she would be wondering how much fun this seaside holiday was going to be. But she had to interrupt the constant deflecting flow of chatter somehow.
"Yes," said Tucker mildly.
"Annie?"
"Are you okay?"
"I feel fine."
"I mean, are you allowed to just walk out of hospital without telling anybody?"
"How do you know I haven't told anybody?"
"I'm just guessing, from the speed at which we left the hospital."
"I said goodbye to a couple of people."
"Who?"
"You know, friends I've made in there. Hey, is that the Royal Albert Hall?"
She ignored him. He shrugged. Have you still got any balloons inside you? Because you won't find anyone to take those out in Ghoulinus. This wasn't turning out right. She was talking to him as if she were his mother. If, that is, he'd been born somewhere in Yorkshire or Lancashire in the 1950s, to parents who ran a boarding house. She could almost hear the bare linoleum and the boiled liver in her voice. No, I told you. I might have some little vent thing left in there, but it won't bother you. Well, it will bother me if you keel over and snuff it. What does keel over and snuff it mean, Dad? Doesn't mean anything. English crap. We don't have to come and stay, okay? If you're uncomfortable, just drop us off at a hotel somewhere. Have you seen all your family? If she could just get through her list of questions, she would turn herself into a host, a good one, welcoming and worldly and obliging. Yep, said Tucker. We had a jolly old tea party yesterday afternoon. Everyone's fine, everyone got on, all good. My work there is done. Annie tried to catch Jackson's eye, but the boy was staring out of the taxi window with a suspicious intensity. She didn't know him, but it seemed to her that he was trying not to look at her. She sighed. Okay, then. She had done her part. She had checked on his health, and she had checked on whether he had fulfilled his paternal responsibilities. She couldn't refuse to believe him, and she didn't want to do that anyway. Jackson was happy enough on the train, mostly because he was taking a crash course in English sweets. He was allowed to go to the cafe car whenever he felt like it. He came back with pastels and biscuits and crisps, and he rolled the exotic words around his mouth as if they were Italian wines. Tucker, meanwhile, was sipping litigiously hot tea from a styrofoam cup and watching the little townhouses roll out in front of him. It was all very flat out there, and the sky was full of ill-tempered dark grey swirls. So what is there to do in your town? Do? And then she laughed. Sorry, the combination of ghoulinous and an active verb took me by surprise. We won't be staying long anyway. Just until your children have given up on you and started traveling the thousands of miles back home. Ouch. I'm sorry. And she was. Where was this disapproval coming from all of a sudden? Wasn't his checkered past half the attraction? What was the point of becoming attracted to a rock musician if she wanted him to behave like a librarian? How is Grace, anyway? Jackson flashed his father a look, and Annie caught it before examining it and lobbing it along to its intended recipient. Yeah, Gracie's doing good, living in Paris with some guy studying to be... something. I know you didn't see her.
Shut up, God!
I did, didn't I, Jacko?
You did, Dad, yeah, I saw you.
You saw him seeing her?
Yeah, I was watching all the time he was looking at her and talking to her.
You're a little fibber and you're a big fibber.
Neither of them said anything. Maybe they had no idea what a fibber was. Why that one? Which one?
Why Grace?
Why Grace what?
How come you don't mind seeing the others, but she scares you?
She doesn't scare me. Why would she scare me?
Maybe Duncan should be sitting on the train listening to this stuff. She knew already that Duncan would give an eye and several internal organs to be sitting on the train listening to this stuff. She meant that it would do him good to be here, that his obsession with this man would dwindle away, perhaps to nothing. Any relationship, it seemed to her, was reduced by proximity. You couldn't be awestruck by someone sipping British Rail tea while he lied shamelessly about his relationship with his own daughter. In her case, it had taken about 3 minutes for passionate admiration and dreamy speculation to be replaced by a nervous, naggingly maternal disapproval. And that, it seemed to her, was a pretty good description of how some of her married female friends felt some of the time. She had married Tucker somewhere between the hospital room and the taxi.
I don't know why she would scare you, said Annie, but she does.
There was something about the journey to Gulinus that reminded Tucker uncomfortably of the old curiosity shop. He didn't think he was crawling through the English countryside to die, although English trains surely didn't move much faster than Little Nell and her dad, and they'd had to walk to wherever the hell they were going. The train